So this morning, I'd like to talk about what it feels like to be kissed. So why don't we do this? Just turn to a neighbor, and when I say kiss, kiss them. Just kidding. And then describe the feeling of being kissed. Just when I say kiss, what comes to mind? All right, I'll give you a couple minutes. Go. All right. Any thoughts? Any parents sitting next to teenagers have a good discussion? What comes to mind when you think of being kissed or kissing? Anybody? Acceptance. Good. Anybody else? Intimacy. Partnership. What was that? Hall and Oates. Yeah. Anybody in the back? Underwhelming. Say more. I'm just kidding. So I was thinking through this, and some of you may have seen this video before, but it's of kids kissing. So check it out. And it kind of made me wonder, is that what your first kiss feels like? Are those the emotions going through? So you may be wondering why we're talking about this morning. There is a reason. I was listening to the physicist Carlo Rovelli, and he was on Being, and he was talking about how all reality is interaction. He says when we see reality, we think of it as static things, but he says all reality is actually, even at a molecular level, just interactions. He says when you see a stone, you want to think of it as just an object, but he says a stone is just a temporary gathering of dust. Isn't that beautiful? And then, so how he talks about it, I was listening to him talk, and what he was saying at a level of physics, at a molecular level, he was basically saying the same thing that Martin Buber, 100 years ago, the philosopher, would say. He says, a lot of us, we have an I-it relationship to the world, and so we objectify the world and people around us. And Martin Buber is saying that we should have an I-thou relationship, a subject to subject, so you don't objectify, but you see people as actual beings and you interact with them. And so what Carlo Rovelli was saying, at the level of physics, at a molecular level, you could say the same thing. This is what he says. So to better understand the world, we shouldn't reduce it to things. We should reduce it to a happening. And the happenings are always between different systems, always relations. He said, fundamentally, this world is relational. The universe is relational. Or he says, or always like a kiss, which is something that happens between two persons. And I thought, what a beautiful, wonderful way to think of the way we interact with reality, rather than interacting with objects and things, to interact with this universe and people around us with a kiss. And so this morning, I wanted to think of that in terms of how we interact with community. So for better or for worse, I do the same thing. Sometimes we see communities as these objective things, and then you and I have these fundamental spiritual needs. We have these needs for the pursuit of truth, to be fed knowledge, for spiritual relationships. And then we determine whether these objective communities, these things, can meet our need or they can't. And I thought, what if we thought of our interaction with the community more like a kiss? And that each of us, as we interact, there's a happening and a thing that happens. And I want to propose that our investment in community in the world we live in may be more important than ever before. If you think about this world, probably for most of us, the last few months, the last year, politically, globally, has been challenging. It's been hard, overwhelming, right? From Brexit to the Philippines, to Syria, to Egypt, to this fictional thing of politics that we're living in this country. And sometimes we don't know how to handle that. And how do you even function? How do you even make steps? And I read Jean Vanier's book, Community and Growth. So he wrote in 1979. It's no longer in print, but if you Google it, there's a PDF that you can just download and read the whole thing. But he said this in 1979. He said, this is why communities have value, our investment in community. He said this: as long as there are fears and prejudices in the human heart, there will be war and bitter injustice. It is only when hearts are healed and becoming loving and open, that the great political problems will be solved. As fears and prejudices diminish and trust in God and others grow, the community can radiate and witness to a style and quality of life which will bring a solution to the troubles of our world. The response to war is to live like brothers and sisters. The response to injustice is to share. The response to despair is a limitless trust and hope. The response to prejudice and hatred is forgiveness. To work for community is to work for humanity. To work for peace and community through acceptance of others as they are, through constant forgiveness, is to work for a peace in the world and for true political solutions. It is to work for the kingdom of God. And so, friends, what would it look like this morning for us to really, with vigor, interact and build this beautiful thing called community? And what would it look like for us to interact like a kiss? And so this morning, I wanted to explore that. Our lectionary text this morning will be in Philippians chapter 1. As is our custom, we'll have it on the screens. Read it to a neighbor, and then we'll walk through it. Philippians chapter 1. Go. All right. Let's pick this up in verse 3. So Paul says, I thank God every time I remember you. So he says, every time I think about you, every time I remember you, the feeling I get is gratitude. Constantly praying with joy. So every time I'm praying for you, if you're this community pops up in my mind as I'm praying, there's joy. And then he says, because of your sharing in the gospel from the first day until now. So he's saying, when I think of this community, there's so much joy, so much gratitude. Because from the first day, you weren't like, this is Paul's work, this is the apostles' work, and then we'll just take from them. From the first day, this gospel was shared. It was collaborated in. The word is actually participated. You understood that the fundamental nature of this work was participatory. I have a friend, she's a pastor in Portland, and I was with her recently, and she says, our church doesn't do evangelism. I go, interesting. And she goes, because God is evangelizing all of us. All the world is being evangelized. We all get to participate and share in it. And I thought, oh, that's so beautiful. So I was thinking through this. So why is Paul filled with joy because everyone's participating? Is it that he's got an agenda, like he's got a movement, and he's like, well, we need these communities to be more efficient, and like Philippi is kind of like doing well, but if Ephesus could see it, and like Colossae, and it's like, look at Philippi, they're doing better because we got to grow this movement. I've got a goal and agenda. I propose that maybe why he's filled with joy that everyone's participating. Maybe the gospel tells us that we are fundamentally beautiful and that our beauty is worth sharing. And that as we step into community, when you walk through the doors, we need to remind it that, oh, I have an inherent beauty and this beauty needs to be shared. So maybe we can think of it like this. Maybe we can think of it in terms of music and musicians. So sometimes we've talked about this at a staff level. Have you ever seen a show where the musician's amazing, but the beauty is like all absorbed on the stage? Like the musician's like, look at me, look how talented I am, look how beautiful I am, look how beautiful these, like the beauty is absorbed, like the direction of it's going on the stage. So there's a musician that I like very much. I still do. I've seen him live a couple times, but the whole time it's like, look at my lyrics, they're so beautiful. Look at my violin, it's so beautiful. Look at the way I whistle, it's so beautiful. And this artist's name is Andrew Bird. So check out the clip.
At best was all he had to say when pressed about the rest of it, the world that is. From proto-Sanskrit Minoans to potocentric Lisboans, Greek Cypriots and Habasats who hang around the ports a lot,
You can almost sense it. Look at me, look how beautiful my face is and how I whistle. And I actually still like him. It is very beautiful. And then there's other musicians, when you see them, there's a beauty to it, but there's this sense like the beauty needs to be shared. Like this beauty is for all of us. Like join me in this beauty. And a band that I've seen that, you know, I get this experience is Beirut. So check out the clip. See that sense where beauty is absorbed or beauty is shared? And I think with musicians, it's fine. It's totally subjective. But I think with communities, I think it's important for us to know our inherent beauty and to trust that when we walk through these doors, the beauty's meant to be shared. You know, so I missed Vox for a couple weeks. I was speaking in Seattle, then I was speaking at Mustard Seed. And then I came back the day I was at Mustard Seed and we had our cleanup day. And if you were here, Jenna calls this her favorite Sunday of the year. And I've never thought about it like that, but I'm now claiming it my favorite Sunday of the year too. And the thing is, it's not the cleaning itself. I didn't realize this until the cleaning. The cleaning is actually just a vehicle of the community. And so I walked in, I remember in the courtyard, I think Jose was back there, Madeline was back there pulling weeds. In the back room, Errol and Jenna, they were cleaning, blowing dust. In the back room, there was Autumn and Amy, they were cleaning the toys, and James Miller was doing the cables. Gina was cleaning this really funky frozen water at the bottom of the freezer, God bless her heart. And as I was participating in it, the cleaning was just something we were doing mindlessly. But you walked into each room and you could sense the beauty of each person being shared with one another. It was really beautiful. And then I came back the Sunday after, it was Mother's Day, and then Kelly gave this beautiful homily, and then Sarah led the Eucharist. And I just felt such honor to be a part of this community. It was really beautiful. And then it dawned on me, like as beautiful as this is, and I feel really lucky to be a part of it, it's probably less than 50% of us sharing our beauty, which is okay. To me, that just means, man, imagine if 95, 100% of us walked in and said, there's beauty that I can share in this moment. What would this community look like? And so maybe a question we can ask here is this. So when we walk into this room, what's our posture of interaction? Like, how do we kiss the community? Are we maybe consumers, which often I am, because that's what I'm taught. Or you can keep going. Maybe some of us, we walk in as a critic or an expert or a performer. Those two are like my go-tos. Like I walk in, like I kind of do this for a living. So let me critique and I'm the expert. Or I'll try to perform. Or what would it look like for us? Our posture, our kiss is participation. So maybe this is a spiritual practice. Go to the next slide. What would it look like to participate in sharing your beauty in community? And I propose that maybe our space here is just so we can practice and we can kiss the world around us. It's not that you just do it here, But our posture is so we can live this way. So here's some examples. So maybe you could offer a hug. That might be enough. Sign up to serve. Send a gentle smile. Saying an encouraging word. What would that look like if all of us saw this work and the work that God's doing that all of us are in, but all of us are being evangelized into? What if we participate and share it? All right, let's keep going. Verse 6. So he says, I'm confident of this, that the one who began a work in you, so someone started this. You didn't start this. Someone initiated this work in you. And this person who did it, God who did it, will bring it to completion, or literally means perfection, by the day of Jesus Christ. So he's saying this. So the work isn't ours to do. We're like clay. And God's like this beautiful potter, and he's shaping us to perfection. Or in a garden, we're not even the vine. We're like the branches. And there's this beautiful artist as a gardener, and he's tilling the soil and watering this plant, this vine, these branches to perfection. So something's being done to us, and we're being perfected. So to me, this raises a question. Like, what does that mean then? Like, how are we being perfected? Like, what ways am I being perfected? So I was taught this was moral and behavioral perfection. I'm not sure that's true. So I think along the ways, I'm trying to be loved by God and learning to love God. I think I've had some unhealthy patterns that slowly have been healed. Then that's like the tiny part of it. But most of it is more me realizing the things I think were my perfection are actually skewed with kind of my imperfection. Does that make sense? Like, I'm more aware of the things I thought were loving that actually aren't that loving. So as I'm loved by God and love God, I'm more aware of like the vastness of my imperfection. So if it's moral and behavioral perfection, that's just not what's happened to me. Doesn't seem like good news. Is it theological cognitive perfection? Is it like our precision in knowing God? So I left seminary 20 years ago. I am confident that the more I know about God, the less I know. Like, I think I know less about the vastness of who God is, the more I know God. So that doesn't seem like the case either. So what does it mean then that we're being perfected along the way? So I have a proposal. So what if we went back to Genesis 1, right? And there's this tree of the knowledge of good and evil, which is the tree of judgment. And God's saying, trust me, you don't want to judge. Let me, who's the essence of love, let love judge you. And we're like, no, we want to judge, right? And it turns out we're terrible at judging, right? We judge ourselves first, and then we judge others through the judgment of ourselves. And then shame enters the world. That's the first time we realize we're not enough. So this is my proposal. What if we're being perfected from the need to judge ourselves and others? And what if along the way we're being perfected from our shame? What if that's the case? So let me give you an example. So every year, Easter is a hard year for me, a hard week. It's just a really hard week. For I've been doing this for 20 years. Every year Easter comes, I'm confronted by myself and my ego. And so this is how it goes. I know it's coming. I set some time, like a few weeks. I get a 2-month jump on it. And then sometimes I'll make good decisions, bad decisions. And then the week of, the front part of my brain tells me this. Who you are is enough. It's not a performance. Just come as yourself. And God's story in itself is beautiful enough, right? That's the front part of my brain. The back part of our brain is perform more, do better, dance harder, be funnier, right? And then so this battle's just going on. The week of, every week, every year, I like psych myself up so much. I like get myself into such a tizzy. And then the day of, it's usually fine because I'm only as important as everything else that goes on. It's not that important. But the problem is I can't enjoy Easter. Like, I'm not fully present. So this is how it goes. After that, the next 2 weeks, I spend waterboarding myself with shame. Just like, oh, why did you do that? You're doing this again. Ah. Like, I want people to think of my homily is like figure skating, but it's more like mud wrestling, and it's very disappointing. So for 18 years, I just wouldn't tell anyone. I'd actually kind of pretend to my family, like, it's fine. It's good. And in some ways, it probably looked more impressive, But for 18 years, I felt more alone, and there was more shame in it. And in the last couple years, I thought, I'm just going to try telling the story. So I call it my Easter faceplant, and I tell people about my Easter faceplant. And most people I tell, you know how most people respond? What? You faceplant too? I do too. And then they tell me their faceplant story. Someone told me recently, like, oh, it makes me feel so much better to hear your faceplant story. Can I tell you mine? I'm like, yes, please, please. And so you know what happens? Along the way, I feel less alone in it. And then millimeter by millimeter, the shame is lifted. Jean Vanier says it like this. In community, people let down their barriers. Appearances and masks disappear. This is not easy. Many people have built up their personalities precisely by hiding their wounded hearts behind the barriers of independence and of the attitude, I know and you don't. They are highly active, and their activity is based on the need to assert, to succeed, to control, to do projects, to be recognized. A community comes about when people are no longer hiding from one another, no longer pretending or proving their value to one another. And so for us, maybe as we're being perfected along the way, perfected from our shame, what if a spiritual practice could be this? So this week, I know this might sound scary, but just find a small way to do it. Share a faceplant story. Find a safe person to do it with and said, hey, can I share a faceplant story with you? And maybe you'll get told one in return, perhaps. All right, and let's finish this. And so verse 9, he said, this is my prayer, that your love may overflow more and more with knowledge and full of insight. I think a lot of times we operate that our knowledge will overflow more and more with love. But he says, whatever capacity you have for love right now, that it'll keep expanding and overflowing. And your knowledge of what love means and how you love will continue to expand. Can you imagine that? So I know a couple of weeks ago, Waylon talked about how you don't truly love until you don't want anything in return. So I remember Karen and I, we've been talking about this for a few months. And I remember I came to this point realizing, I don't think I've ever loved anyone. I think all the things I do that I think is love is more bartering. Conscious or unconscious, when I'm doing something, I want something in return. Did you guys listen to the episode of This American Life, The Grand Gestures? So apparently in Utah, when high school students ask each other to dance, they do these huge grand gestures. It often involves an animal and a pun. So I'll give you a few examples. So one person was inviting someone else to a wedding. They put a pair of goats in someone's house. And then the goat had a sign around his neck. And the sign said, I'm not kidding. I'd love to goat to the dance with you. It's pretty good. Another person left a basket of 4 baby kittens, which probably isn't fair. If you leave kittens, like a basket of them, they'll probably say yes. So in the basket, there's a note. I'm not kitten when I say I want to go to the dance with a cool cat like you. High school students are so wonderful. And there's one more. Someone left a chicken this was in response. So I guess the response has to be as big if you want to say yes. So someone was responding to an invitation. They left a live chicken with Starburst tied around the chicken's neck. And the note said, I'm not going to chicken out on you. I've been bursting to say yes. Young love. So Ira Glass kept pressing. It's like, why do you guys, like, what are you doing? Like, why do you go out of your way? Like, it seems like the invitation is more important than the dance. So like, yeah, that's true. And then he kept pushing. And then this one person says, if I'm honest, it's too scary to ask someone face to face. Because I'm worried that if I'm not enough, that's at least this big act will make them say yes. I'm afraid of rejection. And I was like, oh, it's, you know, like I can relate so much to that. Because to love, to be known, to love is so scary. And we're doing all these things, and what we want to know is, am I actually lovable? Or as Kendrick says, if I didn't ride Blade on curb, would you still love me? He's saying, if I didn't drive these fancy cars on a curb, would you still love me? If I minimize my net worth, if all these things I do, would you still love me? And that's the question we're all asking.
Okay.
So I came to this point where I go, I don't think I've loved anyone. I've just been loving myself through the world around me. So this text then says that we pray that our love can overflow more and more, that I can grow in understanding and insight of my love. So I know what's not loving. What does it look like then to love? That was actually a hard question. It took me quite a few weeks to even have like a resemblance of an answer. If most of my love is I just want something in return, what does it mean to love? Jean Vanier says this. To love someone is not to first of all do things for them, but to reveal to them their beauty and value, to say to them through our attitude, through our energy, you are beautiful, you are important, I trust you, you can trust yourself. To love someone is to reveal to them their capacity for life, the light that is shining in them. Does that make sense? And what I realized is instead of mirroring to people, you're lovable, you're important, you're beautiful. I've been running around my whole life using people as mirrors. I didn't know if this was lovable and worthy. So I'm doing good things, loving things, impressive things, creative things, smart things, loyal things, fun things, controlling things. And what I'm saying is let me do all these things and mirror back to me that I'm worthy of love. And what Jean Vanier is saying, no, when we come into community, be the mirror. Turn to each other and tell them you are worthy of love. You are beautiful. You are important. I'll read the quote one more time. He says, to love someone is to not first of all do things for them, but to reveal to them their beauty and value. Say to them through your attitude, you are beautiful. You are important. I trust you. You can trust yourself. To love someone is to reveal to them their capacity for life, the light that is shining in them. And when I read this, you know what I realized? I go, oh, that's what Paul is doing. I don't think he's writing this letter because maybe the community is acting in a way that's worthy of joy and gratitude, but he's trying to give them a mirror. You are worthy of joy. You are worthy of gratitude. He was trying to give them a kiss they didn't know they deserved. And so Vox, this morning, receive this kiss from Paul, that as you are now with your light and your shadows, with your strengths and your weaknesses, with your beauty and the things that we're ashamed of, you are worthy of joy. You are worthy of gratitude. You are worthy of gratitude. You are worthy of joy. And let me close with a prayer and a poem by Mary Oliver. She says this. I know someone who kisses the way a flower opens, but more rapidly. Flowers are sweet. They have short, beatific lives. They offer much pleasure. There is nothing in the world that can be said against them. Sad, isn't it, that all they can kiss is the air? Yes, yes, we are the lucky ones. In the mercy of the Father, the grace of the Son, and the kiss of the Holy Spirit. Amen.